Tonight's scripture reading will be from Matthew chapter 16, verses 18 through 19. Matthew chapter 16, verses 18 through 19. And I'll be reading from the New English Translation. "And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will have been bound in heaven, and whatever you release on earth will have been released in heaven."
Alrighty, good evening. Hope everyone had a good afternoon, relaxing time. Good day to just take a nap, especially as we're getting to the colder part of the year. Man picked up a 1969 Ford Mustang. But here's the problem. It looked terrible. It was all rusted. The floorboards were all rusted, the inside panels were all rusted, hadn't been driven in 20 years, so the hoses were deteriorated, the seals were all messed up, so he starts working. He starts replacing the floorboard, starts replacing the panels, and he cracks on the dash, he gets those all fixed, gets the hoses replaced, and by the end of it, it looks like a brand new car. What was his original intention? It was to restore the car back to the way that it came off the lot, right? That's the idea of restoration, to restore it to the way that it originally was. And so how are you going to accomplish that? What's the plan? Does he just walk in up to the car and go, "Well, I'll just put some wings on it over here. That should make it look like the way it came from the lot. I'll put a bright purple stripe down the middle of it." Probably not, right? He has to look at the manufacturer's plans. He has to say, how did the manufacturer say that this should look? And let me go and do it that way. Tonight, I want us to think about the restoration of the church. And this brings up a few good questions, such as, why did the church need restoring? How did it get restored? Is it done being restored? To what should it be restored, and have we restored the church? I'm not going to hit on those, like a five-point lesson, but we're going to answer those questions spread throughout the lesson. So our first idea to look at is the church, and that is in Matthew 16. Who established the church? As was read to you, Jesus says, in verse 18 of Matthew 16, "And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." This church belongs to Jesus. There's none other that it belongs to. And as you go into how the church should act, we get into verse 19, which I gave the New English Translation because it does a better job with the original language here. The idea in verse 18, yours may read, in verse 19, may read, "I will give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." That's how the English Standard Version translates it. But really, that's not a good translation. And some have taken this passage to make Peter more than what he was, to give Peter more authority than what he ever had. This is a passage that some people look at and say, well, you know, whatever Peter decided, and those that succeeded Peter, whatever they decide is how the church should look. But what the passage says is what was read from the New English Translation, what has been loosed or what has been bound in heaven will be loosed. All that means is that what Peter preaches is nothing different than what God has already ordained, what God has already chosen. There should be no difference. In fact, let's think for a second. Let's say that Peter did have authority. Do you think the church would look the way that Jesus wanted it to look? I don't think so. Even think to Galatians, when he had the issue of racism, when he would eat with the Gentiles, but then when the Jews would come in, he would suddenly walk away and just not deal with the Gentiles anymore. That's not the church that Jesus established. If Peter had a say as to what the church looked like, it would look different. If I had a church of what the, if I had an idea or the authority to determine what the church looked like, it would look different. Because I'm not the one who built it. I'm not the one who owns it. Rather, Jesus is the sole person who can determine what the church looks like. So whatever we see the church do when Christ initially set it up, that's the way that Christ wanted it to look. And of course, we know that this plan is laid out in the book of Acts. We see a pattern theology there. We see that Christ established a pattern, a plan, and we see that fulfilled. And when things got off a little bit, we would see a new revelation. We would see a redirection. So then that way, what Christ established is what would happen. And there have been times in which the church has not done what it was intended to do. There have been times in which the church did veer off from the pattern. One of the first times that this happened was in the 4th century with Constantine. Constantine, emperor of Rome, took over, started building churches that faced the east because he thought that Jesus and Sol Invictus, or the sun god, were the same god. And so he thought, well, Jesus is the same as Sol Invictus, so we've got to build the churches set this way. It was a lot of pomp, a lot of procession in the worship that Constantine established, and it was very different than the early church pattern. Even today, how many churches have elders? If you're going down the street, how many church signs do you see that say Pastor So-and-so? Thankfully, ours doesn't. If it did, we'd have six men to list, right, for our pastors, but many churches just have one. What about baptism for the necessity of salvation? How many churches today believe in that? So when we're talking about the restoration of the church, we have to realize that this is nothing new that Christendom in general has veered off, but we have to be aware of it. Some, even in the Church of Christ, especially in the past, were not known for the right attitude. There was a time in the Church of Christ history in which it seemed like we loved truth more than people. Now, it's good to love truth, but without the love of people, it's no good. But thankfully, I think the Spirit of the Lord is being restored in the church today. In fact, one of my first conversations with Tim, he was talking about after you all decided to hire me for the youth and ministry, youth and family program. Tim said, you know, we're going to have some people come out and help you unload your moving van. And I said, wow, that's great. I wasn't expecting that. And he said, well, that's what the church is supposed to do. I said, yes, that's right. That's what the church is supposed to do. But it's just hard to find that. And so I think that especially this church has done a good job of restoring first century spirit of the Lord. But restoring the church means getting it back to the way that Christ built it. Think for a moment with me about the Reformation movement. 16th century movement led by men such as Zwingli, Luther, Calvin. And while I don't agree with them on many points theologically, at the end of the day, their desire to get back to the Bible is what spurned so much of history into where we are today. And then you get into the Restoration movement in the 19th century, led by men such as Alexander Campbell, Barton Stone, Walter Scott. But maybe we feel like the church has been restored after the Restoration movement. One would think that with there being a whole movement dedicated towards it, we'd get there, right? But restoration isn't something that's a one-time deal. It's like cleaning a gun. If you get a gun, you go out and you fire it, and you clean it one time, and then you go fire 20,000 rounds through it, that's not going to be good for the gun, right? You need to break it down every time you fire it, clean it, so there aren't any issues. It's like a house. If we just let our house go whatever way it goes to deterioration, and we don't clean up after ourselves, we don't fix boards as they start creaking, we just let it go, what's going to eventually happen? The house is going to look dilapidated. So restoration is an ongoing thing. Look over in 1 Timothy chapter 1. And starting in verse 3. Paul says, "As I urged you when I was going to Macedonia, remain at Ephesus so that you may charge certain persons not to teach any different doctrine, nor to devote themselves to myths and endless genealogies, which promote speculation rather than stewardship from God that is by faith. The aim of our charge is love that issues from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. Certain persons, by swerving from these, have wandered away into vain discussion, desiring to be teachers of the law, without understanding either what they are saying or the things which they make confident assertions about." So here we see Paul leaving Timothy in Ephesus. Why? To make sure that no one swerves from the faith. It's like when you're driving a car, right? You don't just line it up and then just let go. Because if you did, what would happen? You'd end up in a crash. You'd end up in a wreck. It's about constant recalculation. It's about constantly keeping the car on the right path, on the right road. 2 Peter chapter 1. Starting in verse 12. "Therefore, I intend always to remind you of these qualities, though you know them and are established in the truth that you have. I think it is right, as long as I'm in this body, to stir you up by way of reminder." So here's Peter saying, even though I know that you know this, I'm going to do what? I'm going to remind you. It's a constant recalculation to make sure we're all on the right path. Look over in Jude chapter 1 and verse 5. "Now I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved a people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe." Now, here Jude is reminding these people of something that they once knew. But the interesting thing is that Jude is writing to these people that were the same people, the same recipients of the letter that was sent to 2 Peter. And so we go from 2 Peter, in which they knew it, so Peter's constantly reminding them, to Jude, and Jude is saying, "You once knew this. Let's talk about this again." So it's an ongoing process. So what are the dangers that face the restoration process? Well, the first one is that when we think restoration is done. Again, imagine restoring an old dresser. Pick up an old dresser at flea market or something like that. You get it home, take off the old varnish, start sanding it a little bit, and then you go, good enough. No. It wouldn't be done. It wouldn't be finished. Second thing, thinking that we have arrived or that this is as good as it gets. When we think that the church is as good as it gets, that's when we have another problem on our hands. Look over in 2 Kings chapter 22. 2 Kings 22. And this is Josiah who's reigning at this point. And there's a bit of excitement because the book of the law has been found. 2 Kings 22, starting in verse 8, it says, "And Hilkiah the high priest said to Shaphan the secretary, 'I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord.' And Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, and he read it. And Shaphan the secretary came to the king and reported to the king, 'Your servants have emptied out the money that was found in the house and have delivered it into the hand of the workmen who have the oversight of the house of the Lord.' Then Shaphan the secretary told the king, 'Hilkiah the priest has given me a book.' And Shaphan read it before the king. And when the king heard the words of the book of the law, he said, well, this is as good as it gets. Is that how yours reads? No. When the king heard the words of the book of the law, he tore his clothes. Now imagine that, being so upset about something that you just rip the clothes on your body, right? He recognized that there was an issue. This is a very emotional point. He was showing just how angry he was that the book of the law wasn't being followed. This isn't something that Josiah took lightly. The third danger that faces the restoration process is a lack of Christ-like attitude and biblical knowledge. Look over at John chapter 4. In verse 34, John 4, verse 34. This is after Jesus has the discussion with the woman at the well. The disciples come asking if he's hungry, and Jesus says, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. Jesus says, my attitude, my goal in life, my purpose here is to do what the Father has sent me to do. That's the Christ-like attitude that we need. Whatever God has said, that's what I'm going to do. And when we think about it as to what that meant for Jesus, that meant to the point of death. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 6. Contextually, this is a discussion about bondservants, slaves, servants, with their masters. But the principle, I think, is universal. Ephesians 6:6. Not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart. See, it's one thing to have it up here. And it's another thing to have it in our emotions. But it's a completely different thing when those two intersect and we have it in the heart, isn't it? That's when we realize what we need to do. We have the will and the spirit about us that's right. And when those two intersect, that's when it's being done from the heart. That's when we know we're on the right track. But we must also, of course, know what the Bible says. And so the question is, do we study our Bible or do we read our Bible? And those are two very different things, aren't they? I can read the Bible all I want, and there's nothing wrong with that. But how much do I study? And maybe that's a different question for us. There's a need for restoration. The church is in constant need of course correction. I want us to think about the church at Ephesus. Here, we see Paul spending 3 years with the church at Ephesus. He says that in Acts chapter 20 and verse 31. So this would have left us around AD 57. This is when Paul would have left Ephesus. We're right at AD 57. He wrote the book of Ephesians in AD 60. Then he wrote 1 Timothy around AD 62 to AD 64. So 57, we're looking at about 5 to 6 years. In 5 to 6 years, we go from a church that Paul is weeping with, and Paul's warning them, and now in 1 Timothy, Timothy, these are what elders look like. We need elders at the church of Ephesus. 5 to 6 years? And we're having an issue with what seems to be an eldership? Constant course correction. The book of Revelation, I'll give you both dates just to throw them both out there. Most people hold the position that the book of Revelation is written around AD 95. I take it more as 69 to early 70. But even if it were written in AD 95, that's about 30 years from 1 Timothy. In 30 years, John is writing to those at Ephesus saying what? You've lost your first love. And that's even a bigger deal if, as I hold, it was only 6 or 7 years later. You've lost your first love. How can a church that's had an apostle with them for 3 years deteriorate that fast? Was it a societal issue? No, it's a constant need for course correction, a constant restoration process. So let's talk about the spirit of restoration. The first thing is that the spirit of restoration is one that challenges and questions everything. I want us to think over to Acts chapter 17, starting in verse 10. And you all know this account really well. Paul had been in Thessalonica. He was not received well there, to say the least. He ends up at Berea. And so in Acts 17, verse 10, the brothers immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. And when they arrived, they went into the Jewish synagogue. Now, these Jews were more noble than those in Thessalonica. They received the word with all eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. Many of them therefore believed, with not a few Greek women of high standing as well as men. And so I want us to think about this for a minute. Paul comes in. He says, "Hi, I'm an apostle. Apostle Paul, I've got some things to talk to you about. The Messiah who you've been waiting for thousands of years has come, and you all ended up crucifying." And they start studying, and they start looking into it. Notice it doesn't say that Paul got upset with them because they questioned his authority. It says they were more excellent because they questioned an apostle. They studied to make sure that what was said was right. So when someone's teaching, can I question them? Absolutely. If an apostle can be questioned, how much more can Greg Ryan be questioned, right? I mean, I'm not getting any visions at night to go to certain cities. I'm not getting spoken to by God on the way to Damascus. So why? Why shouldn't Greg be questioned? I should. If we don't question the one's teaching, then we run the risk of following men and not God. I want us to remember that Christ was killed in part because he questioned the religious authorities of the day. Now, especially when I started really digging into Scripture, one of the things that kind of bugged me, I was asking the question, well, why didn't the Jews of the day that were following after the Pharisees and the Sadducees and all them, why didn't they just question? Why didn't they just say, you know, this isn't right. We shouldn't be doing it this way. We need to be doing something different. And that really bugged me. But on the other hand, if I expect them to do it, then I should also expect myself to do it. So if, for example, Brotherhood publication, person speaking, sometimes we fall into the trap of listening, digesting, and then just walking away without processing. And I've done it. But that's a really dangerous thing. So, questioning everything. It's not about being in a state of constant flux. Rather, the desire is to be biblical, and that should outweigh our desire to be comfortable. Now, this has upset some people along the way. Of course, we see what happened to Jesus. But even in our own people, this has maybe caused some discomfort. But why does it upset us? We look at the congregation down the road. We wonder why they won't question their beliefs. So it'd be hypocritical if we don't question ours, as we should. So the restoration process. After we've sought the answers in the pattern of Scripture, we need to see what the response should be. First, this is an attitude of complete buy-in. Restoration is not a halfway kind of deal, right? It was like the dresser that we're trying to restore. It's not a halfway kind of deal. Jesus is not a halfway kind of master. We either belong to him or we belong to Satan. Those are our two options. Look over in Acts chapter 19. In verse 18. Chapter 19 and verse 18. Also, many of those who were now believers came, confessing and divulging their practices. And a number of those who had practiced magic arts brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all. And they counted the value of them and found it to be 50,000 pieces of silver. That's a lot of money. I mean, at the very least, it would be like 50,000 days' wages. That's a lot of time off, right? I mean, we could sit back and go, man, think about all the good that can be done out of that, right? But these people were more concerned about separating themselves from sin than they were about anything else. So the question becomes, are we willing to do that with things in our own life? Now, obviously, the things here are important, the things when we come for congregational worship. We have to take a look at each of those and ask, do they belong or do they not belong? But what about the things in our own life? Is there music that you listen to that it would be better to throw away the CD? Is there a movie that you have at home that it would be better to get rid of it, throw it away or delete it or whatever? Are there websites that need to be blocked on your computer because it's better to follow Jesus? That's restoration. That's investment. That's buy-in into Jesus. But the response also has to be one of immediacy. When we think about Josiah that we read earlier, 2 Kings chapter 22, we see that Josiah made an immediate effort, tore the clothes, started into immediate impact of trying to fix the situation. Look over in 2 Chronicles chapter 29. And here we see Hezekiah. 2 Chronicles chapter 29. Starting in verse 1. Hezekiah began to reign when he was 25 years old. Okay. So I want us to imagine ourselves a 25-year-old king. And he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abijah, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord according to all that David his father had done. In the first year of his reign, so 25 years old, in the first month, he opened the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. He brought in the priests and the Levites and assembled them in the square on the east and said to them, "Hear me, Levites. Now consecrate yourselves and consecrate the house of the Lord, the God of your fathers, and carry out the filth from the holy place. For our fathers have been unfaithful and have done what was evil in the sight of the Lord our God. They have forsaken him and have turned away their face from the habitation of the Lord, and they've turned their backs. They also shut the doors of the vestibule and put out the lamps, and have not burned incense or offered burnt offerings in the holy place to the God of Israel. Therefore, the wrath of the Lord came on Judah and Jerusalem, and he's made them an object of horror, of astonishment, and of hissing, as you have seen with your own eyes. For behold, our fathers have fallen by the sword, and our sons and our daughters and our wives are in captivity for this. Now it is in my heart to make a covenant with the Lord, the God of Israel, in order that his fierce anger may turn away from us. My sons, do not now be negligent, for the Lord has chosen you to stand in his presence, to minister to him, and to be his ministers, and to make offerings to him." Who is this 25-year-old coming in and telling us how to do our job? You think maybe that's what some of them thought? You think that maybe some of them said, "I don't know what you're talking about. It seems pretty good to me. I've got food on the table. I'm pretty happy. The family's pretty happy. And how dare you talk about my dad like that?" Hezekiah because he had put it in his heart to make a covenant with the Lord, said, "We need restoration." And of course, last but not least, the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts 8:36. Here's some water. What stops me from being baptized? Let's do it right now. Let's get this thing done. Let's get on the right track starting today. It's an attitude of immediacy. But lastly, it's also an attitude of not fearing man. And this is one that I struggle with. One of my struggles is that, particularly when it comes to working with other people, I tend to want to please people. I want to get the work done. I want to make sure everyone's happy. I want to make sure no one's upset. And if I were a 25-year-old king like Hezekiah, I mean, wow, it humbles me to read about Hezekiah. Because for as much as I say, oh yeah, I would have done that, I don't know. That would be a hard position to be in. I hope that I would have the faith to do that. But when I look at people like Josiah, Hezekiah, the Ethiopian eunuch, and all the others that started making the changes, even though they upset some people, they continued to restore no matter what. No matter what it cost them, and no matter who it hurt, whether relationally or even financially. But as I said earlier, we are blessed at Central, I do believe, because this is, as I've told my wife, this is the closest I've seen to the New Testament pattern as I've found anywhere. And there's a spirit here at Central that I think also exemplifies first century Christianity in a way that I've not seen many otherwise. And when we go to visit family in Northern Virginia, the church there is not as strong as it is here. And one of the things that Megan and I talked about as we came home for Thanksgiving, we talked about how blessed we are to be a part of Central. And so I really do want us to realize how blessed Central is and how good of a job we do at restoring right things, whether it's pattern of worship, the spirit of worship, spirit of giving, spirit of doing work in the community. But we don't want to rest on our laurels either. We have an opportunity before us to restore the church even further. And that's where you come in, to think about how we can get closer to the Bible today than we were yesterday. Closer to the pattern of first century worship today than we were yesterday. There are things that we can always improve on, and I want to encourage us to seek those things. As some of you know, I'm a Patriots fan, and so whenever there's a big win, Bill Belichick will get a lot of questions like, "Wow, it was a great game out there, Bill." And Bill Belichick, the head coach of the Patriots, will stand up and go, "Oh, we need to improve on a lot of things. We need to get special teams fixed out there." And he always picks like one thing that he can fix, and he grumbles about it for about 10 minutes. And it kind of stuns some people because they go, "You had a great game. Why is he so focused on not just relishing in the moment?" It's because there's a bigger picture. There's a bigger prize. There's a bigger goal than a single game. And for us as the church, we have a bigger goal. We have a bigger prize. We have a bigger game that we're looking forward to. There's always something we can do better. When will restoration end? The Mustang will deteriorate, the house will rot. Our final verses that we're going to look at, read together, is Revelation 22. "Then the angel showed me the river, the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city, and on either side of the river. The tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be any accursed, but the throne of God and the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads, and night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. That sounds a lot like Genesis 1 and 2. The day restoration ends is the day that Jesus comes back for his own. But until that happens, we keep restoring. And that begins with the personal restoration of your relationship between you and God. If every person in here dedicates themselves to the Lord, and every family dedicates themselves to the Lord, to restoring it, how much better can we be? I know that's what we're aiming for, but I want to encourage you today that if you've not restored that relationship between you and God, here's water. What prevents you? If you have any need tonight, will you come as we stand and as we sing?